Hello, everyone, and welcome back.
Podcast. My name is Simone. Some call me Dr. Erdner. I've taken a little bit of a break from this podcast. It was the beginning of 2026 was a very rough time for me. As some of you all know, I started season two and at the beginning of 2026. Things were going good for about a month. Well, let me back up. Actually, on January 2nd of 2026, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition, and I've been really struggling with that diagnosis to the point that I didn't really share it on this podcast. I just went really insular. I didn't even share with Kyle for about 2 months. I didn't have a specific autoimmune diagnosis such as Sjogren's or lupus or RA. I was on January 2nd, I was told that there is autoimmune activity happening. I had a very high ANA, a 1280 speckled, for those of you who know what those number means. And I was having symptoms, and I was pretty sure I had rheumatoid arthritis because my mom's mom, my maternal grandmother that I never met, she died of breast cancer, had diagnosed rheumatoid arthritis. And my symptoms were very rheumatoid arthritis related. It was joint pain, my hands and my feet were swelling, the joints were hurting, a lot of that was going on. So that was January 2nd. They couldn't get me in, and this is a tale as old as time in medicine. I couldn't get my follow-up ultrasound to that ANA tilter until March 20th. So we were looking at 3+ months of needing to wait. So in that waiting time, the grieving process happened. I was in denial for most of it. I was bargaining a little bit. I was all over the place. Again, to the point that I never really shared with Kyle what those numbers were, because I wanted to wait till I had more data gathered so that when I did sit him down and tell him what was going on, that I was able to say, like, okay, this is all we know. This is the diagnosis. This is how we move forward. I wanted to have my head wrapped around it rather than sharing it with him. And I don't know. I don't, was that right? I don't know. I'm still in the throes of kind of a deep depression about it. So, this episode itself is a bit more of just an update on taking a break. A lot of variables were going on at that time. January 2nd was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition, but we didn't know what it was. I started ketamine therapy, as you all know. I did about 3 different episodes of ketamine therapy. My third session was on a Wednesday. I went in, blasted off. Was just trusting the process as best I could. And then the next day, on a Thursday, I started getting sick and like really sick, like throwing a fever. Went that Friday morning to my primary care doctor. I had a really bad kidney infection in my auto transplanted kidney. And then it felt like everything from there just went downhill. So I stopped ketamine therapy. One, because I had my kidney infection, so I had to cancel my appointments. You're supposed to do 6 sessions in 4 weeks. So I had to call and say, hey, I can't come to my Friday session, and then let's go ahead. I might call next week depending on how I'm feeling. And I used to bounce back from sickness very quickly. That was not the case with this. It was a very, very, very scary infection. I was at home by myself. Kyle was out of town with his family. My autoimmune condition was through the roof. That was when I was like, there's definitely something going on. I couldn't walk. I was by myself. I was having to crawl to the kitchen. My POTS was out of control. It was kind of the downward domino effect. As I start getting better, I'm getting my fever under control. We have a plumber and a construction worker that are scheduled to come. They come and they're going to rip out all the plumbing and redo it. We live in a very old cabin. And so they turned off the water February 11th. And we have been without basic needs essentially for 2 months. Going, we're still going on. This is still happening. It is April 15th at the time of this recording, April 15th, 2026. So we were without water for about 6 weeks. They finally turned the water back on, but we don't have hot water. We don't have a shower. We have an outhouse, just so everybody knows, which is a little different for most people. We love it. So we did have that, but we had no running water. We finally get running water, but it's not hot water. And then at around that time, we don't have in the middle of all this happening, we got a new stove. Then that stove isn't working, so we have to get GE to come out. And so we still are currently without a stove. So we do have running water. We now have hot running water. We don't have a shower, but we can wash dishes at least. But we have no way to cook food. And this just is a big clusterfuck routine-wise. So, and financially, we've had to eat out every day for 2 months. You try, obviously, we try to do it as healthy as we can, but it's still really expensive. Yeah. Then I don't know if I shared with you all. So I'm going to do some separate episodes. This is more of an update episode just on the clusterfuck that has been 2026 so far. I'll do a separate episode on my autoimmune condition to speak about what I've been learning about that as it relates to vascular compressions. And then I'll do another episode on what I'm about to share, which is at the end of 2025, I did a 90-minute tilt table ultrasound at RIA Endovascular, where it was determined that I had a lot of valve vascular damage in my legs. And so something that I waited whenever I was diagnosed with May Thurner, with Nutcracker, I had venous insufficiency in my legs, but the whole discussion was, well, plumbing, gravity, if we fix what's the northernmost compressions, then your legs will correct themselves. So I just knew, okay, well, if my legs do need procedures completed on them, we're going to wait till the very end. Because if we fix May Thurner, we fix Nutcracker, then, and I did get relief. I did get left leg relief. I got lower back relief with those. However, I was still having problems enough for me to say, I'm going to go get this checked. So I go get it checked, and they see that, yeah, you do have a lot of varicose veins like deep in your legs. They weren't showing in, like, you couldn't visibly see them on my legs. I had a lot of reflux in areas, I had a lot of dilation. So, in those discussions, some of the symptoms that were coming up, just so you all know, is like on a mild day, like, take the dogs for a mile walk. I would get home, my legs would swell by the end of the day. They'd be really achy. I was constantly having to what I call drain my legs, which is put them up on a wall, and that would help. I was wearing my compression stockings more often, and anybody that wears those knows how much those are so uncomfortable and just not it. So I decided to move forward with the leg ablation surgeries. So, which is also very fucking frustrating when we intersect insurance here, because in both of my legs, left and right, there is multiple vascular issues. Insurance will only let us treat one leg per day and only one leg, one vein per leg. So that meant that in my left leg, we treated the great saphenous vein, and on my right leg, we treated I think it was the smaller saphenous vein that's down in my calf. Then you have to go through 2 weeks of wearing your compression and all of these different types of things. I had a couple like kind of minor complications, but nothing major. Then I have to wait 3 months. So my next appointment is in July to redo this 90-minute tilt table ultrasound, which is going to be another medical bill for me, to then see what those results are, then submit the pre-op, which is usually them denying it, and then we have to fight it, and then they'll hopefully approve it. To then get that scheduled to go back in and do one leg at a time. Now, there is an option, there is a possibility we go in and they're like, oh my gosh, these two veins were good. And it seems like that kind of corrected everything else. So we don't really need to do this. There is a possibility there. Given the last 3 years of medical crisis, I am not optimistically going in thinking that's what's going to happen. So, started out with an autoimmune diagnosis. Start the ketamine therapy. That was very intense, but also very good. I'll give you a little bit of an update on that here in a second. Then I fight with insurance on the leg ablation procedures. I go and have, well, actually, start ketamine, get the kidney infection. We lose both our ability to cook and our ability to clean. We have no water. We have to go every day to our neighbor's house to get our water rations, we joked. And some of the silver lining, I don't want to just bitch because we all kind of, there's been a lot of silver lining in this. Like, I have actually created the COPE Center, the Center for Optimal Psychological Education and Injury and Rehabilitation, which has, it has helped me become a better professor as I am a subject matter expert in the psychology of injury and illness. And a lot of my lived experience has absolutely helped me fill the gaps on what we don't know research-wise. So I'm pushing a lot of that forward. I'm doing a lot of research now. So there's some silver lining there. And another silver lining to losing our water and our stove is we've created a better relationship with our quote unquote, I say quote unquote landlords, because they're more like our neighbors' friends. They're an elderly couple that really are do feel more friendly to us as well as, us taking care of them. Very communal energy. So cabin is completely just like unlivable, basically, but we're still living there. There's that stress. I have my kidney infection, all the fear that comes with that. My autoimmune goes insane with this kidney infection. I can't walk. It takes, and my rheumatologist confirmed this, it took about 2 months for my autoimmune condition to really like settle down after that. And I've learned since that that happens with infections, that your immune system goes crazy, your autoimmune condition goes crazy when you do get an infection. So I that's going on. Then I have the leg ablation procedures, and I have to drive down the hill, which is like a four about an hour drive. And because insurance won't let us do them both on the same day, I have to go on a Monday and then turn around Tuesday morning. So my caretaker, Kyle, he's an arborist. Like, this is very inconvenient for him. He's very supportive. He takes me down there. He's not complaining about it, but it's just like another, like this frustration. Like, I have frustration with the diagnosis. I'm not accepting it. I don't have water or a stove to even try to cook healthy food at home. I feel like absolute dog shit because of the autoimmune. My legs are hurting. Is my legs hurting because of the venous insufficiency, or is it the autoimmune? I don't know. I guess we'll find out. On top of all that, at my job, I had some things thrown my way, kind of like emergency things I had to step into. So the beginning of 2026, which is still technically the beginning of 2026, was a clusterfuck for me. We're finally settling in. The term is over. The students have their grades, whether they're happy with them or not. I got all, and then that was also having to navigate that. Some of the students fail the class because they truly do not do good work. And then I'm getting harassed and yelled at in an email. And I'm just like, I don't have the mental capacity. I don't. That's a little bit of an update for me. Now, I want this again, like I stated, I'm going to do another episode on my leg ablation procedures so that those of you who do need to move forward into that can have a better understanding of like the testing that you can do, what you can request, what to expect the day of, things of that nature. Things to advocate for yourself for, too. As we all know, doctors don't tell you some things and you don't know to ask for what you need to ask for. I also am going to update you on my autoimmune condition, which is undifferentiated connective tissue disease. A little bit of a cliff note there. UCTD is a diagnosis they give when you do have biomarkers for an autoimmune condition, which I do, but I don't have the biomarkers for rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, or Sjogren's. I have like a mix of them, and I've kept track of my symptoms. They're mostly RA, but there are some lupusy type symptoms as well. Mouth ulcers, my lymph swelling. So I'm currently in the process of, I've downloaded the Bearable app, which has been recommended on a lot of these different Facebook support groups for me to do like my morning check-ins. You can customize it. I'll be honest with you, I have actually really liked it. I'm somebody that's a little suspect of like the visit, like I don't want to say I am suspect because I feel like there's a lot of people out there taking advantage of those of us with chronic illness. So I'm just like, how much of this app in this visible band is just opportunistic? Like, this is, I am a suspicious person to the nature of myself. Like, I don't trust a lot of things. So I decided, okay, I'll do a 7-day trial of the Bearable app and just see how it's going. And I have to be honest, again, I'm not somebody who's suspect to the point that I won't use things, but I am suspect to the point where I'll do a lot of research on it before I decide to move forward with it. So I looked into the Bearable app. I do like it. It's very customizable. It takes a lot of work in the beginning to set it up, but I do see a psychological component here where, because I've spent a lot of time customizing it, I find myself almost wanting to make decisions, not just for the app, like for myself, obviously, but I know, oh, I'm going to log this later. So I want to make sure I don't log a McDonald's cheeseburger because I know that's not going to help my symptoms, right? And to be fair, last night I did not, I had like a Crunchwrap Supreme. It was just what Kyle brought home. I was just hungry. I knew, but I thought, you know what? This is actually good data gathering. I'll log it in my thing that I had fast food. And then what happens is Bearable, through the algorithm, will then help you see, connect the dots on what symptoms are triggering. And so I do think that that's really, I'm excited about that because one of the overwhelming things and why I think I'm struggling to accept my autoimmune condition is I'm looking to completely overhaul my life. And that's very overwhelming to do as you're still trying to live your life. So I'll do a whole nother separate episode on my autoimmune condition. I'm currently in the process of seeking a second opinion. And I obviously want to make sure that when I record these episodes on my leg ablation, on my autoimmune condition, that I come as prepared as I can with information to give you all. As my whole purpose for this podcast is, it's multifold. It's both for me to tell my story. One of my coping, the ways that I cope is storytelling. The ways that I cope is advocacy. I'm not massive into astrology, but I am an Aquarius. And so I'm a visionary. And I really do visually see life in a way that's more communal and more. And I think that's something that's beautiful about the chronic illness setting is that we know we have to help each other. And that is why I created this podcast. Is not just selfishly for me to tell my story, but a both and. I don't personally just believe in altruism. I believe that we are constantly making decisions on like what's going to feel good for me, but also what is both and going to be beneficial for others. So me wanting to share my story to be beneficial to you almost is like a nutcracker virtual bestie, if you will, to where you can learn from the mistakes I made, the things I wish I would have asked. So I just this episode is a bit of like recentering as I've had some time away to think about where we're at. Now I do want to shift into a follow-up on my ketamine experience. It was very profound. It was a lot. It was convoluted, I'll say. It was very intense, very intense. I mean, again, I was going on Wednesday nights blasting off and then showing up to teach class on at 9 a.m. Thursday. Like, and the student, they're all grad students. I let them know I was doing ketamine therapy. I'm very open with them. I teach a diversity, equity, inclusion course and we talk about disabilities. So I am actively sharing my experience with them through storytelling in the class so that they could understand sport is a very ableist society. So in what ways could my experience help expand their understanding of disability, especially invisible disability, especially indivisible disability in a person with a body like mine that presents in an athletic space is very athletic. And so I get misunderstood a lot. I have been told in the athletic space that can be dramatic. I'm a hypochondriac. And I'm just like, I understand that I look muscular. I understand that I still look athletic. I understand that it looks like I've been working out, but I haven't. And so that can be frustrating in the space that I'm in. So I was doing these ketamine sessions, and like I stated, I did my third session on a Wednesday, woke up on a Thursday, starting to feel very sick, go on Friday, full blown, get the confirmation that I have a kidney infection, and it is bad to the point that they almost sent me to the ER. And I said, is I really my medical trauma is very bad these days, to the point that I had a dermatology appointment of all things, just an annual. And the dermatologist walked in and I just started sobbing. And I didn't even expect there was anything wrong with my skin, truly. So there's that. So we decide to stop the ketamine sessions. And this was in, I had spoken to UW Health, their auto transplant. I talked to Rachel, and there's no research that necessarily says that ketamine is taxing on the kidney, but it was definitely just like, I just felt like I needed to take a step back, that it was more taxing on my body than what it could handle at the moment. I'm glad I did. And this is me. I want to just take a moment. I want to take a beat. I want to take a pause. I want to take a pulse here. I just intuitively felt like I needed to stop. This wasn't a research study that told me I needed to stop. This wasn't the psychiatrist I was seeing telling me to stop. This was me saying, hey, I think I'm going to take a step back. I understand that you all want to do 6 sessions in 4 weeks, but I just think I need to stop. This is a lot for me. Or this just isn't the time. Whatever the reason is, I just intuitively feel like I need to stop and take a pause. And everybody was very supportive of this. And I'll be honest with you, I'm really, really, really glad that I listened to myself. And that's something I've really been trying to center is my agency, centering myself, advocating for myself. Because in the weeks to come after that, and once my kidney infection settled down, I, on most nights, have a very kind of chill routine. I stretch before I go to bed. I drain my legs. And another thing I want to talk from a psychology perspective, I've actually always drained my legs. And as a reminder, when I say drain legs, that means putting my legs up on the wall and my back is like flat on the ground so that the blood from my legs can. The gravity can pull it down and bring it back to my heart. So, and that has been a very beneficial intervention for me in a lot of ways, both for my POTS, for my leg swelling, just for overall organ health because they need blood to function. So, let's get that blood back to the heart so the heart can filter it and get it to the organs that it needs to go to. What some people don't understand about draining legs, though, is I have actually used it as an intervention when I was both a competitive athlete, but I used it as a way to reset both mentally and physically. Because when you can drain your legs or put your legs up on the wall, that there's a 7 to 8, it takes about 7 to 8 minutes to engage. It's a way to engage your parasympathetic system. And I actually can feel this happening. When I usually it's about the 5 minute mark, I can feel my body relax. And it's a biological response because it's relaxing because the blood's getting back to your heart and your heart's filtering it and it's getting it to the organs that it needs. So a lot of a body's stress response and muscle tension could potentially be a blood flow issue because there's tension building up because they're having to overwork because they're not getting the blood that they need. So I wanted to put that bit in there for you all about quote unquote draining your legs, because there is a parasympathetic response that also comes. So, even beyond me getting my legs fixed, I will probably now fully adopt draining my legs most nights, even after I do the leg ablations, et cetera, because they have a really great benefit to helping me sleep better, things of that nature. Again, I'm taking a lot of caveats. I appreciate you going on this journey with me. Back to the ketamine. I took some time off, and one night, most nights, like I was stating, I meditate, I stretch, I drain my legs. This one particular night, I was upstairs draining my legs, about to go to sleep, about to lay down and read. And it was as if all the ketamine sessions came together for me. And this is pretty, I don't even know the word to describe it. Pretty off the wall, pretty profound for me. So, in my ketamine sessions, some of the things that came up for me were being thrust back into my mother's womb, like truly knowing what my body felt like. I was about 5, 6 months gestation and like trying to get her attention that something was wrong. I had a couple other experiences similar as I did more ketamine sessions. Well, about a month later, after stopping the ketamine sessions, I'm draining my legs, and all of a sudden I'm meditating, I'm breathing, I'm not trying to connect the dots. Like, it wasn't like I was trying to have this breakthrough moment. And all of a sudden I start crying, seemingly out of nowhere. And about a second later, I became very aware that I was a fetus that wanted to be aborted. And that was what I was trying to get my mother's attention. Something's wrong. Can we abort this? Can we stop this mission? Can we restart? Can you abort me so I can go back to the souls of souls, wherever you go, and get a little bit of a redo, if you will? And let me just tell you, that might sound a little weird as you're listening to it. I get it. You have a demographic profile that is intersected by multiple identities. One of them might be religious. You might even be listening to this and be somebody who identifies as pro-life. And well, let me redefine that. You might be considered somebody who's pro-life in the sense of how society defines pro-life, how the media defines pro-life, which is anti-abortion. So, I understand that might be weird for you, it might sound uncomfortable. I just want to acknowledge that, okay? There's multiple lived experiences, there's multiple different ways of navigating this world. I am a pro-choice lady. I believe everybody should have their choice on what they do with their body. Now, what I think was a little weirder was not that realization for myself, but what was the feelings and enlightenment that ensued after? I have this epiphany, which makes me cry more. And then all of a sudden, I felt this release. I felt a huge release, a huge emotional release, to be quite frank. Like, I just stopped crying. And I was like, oh my gosh. I'm perplexed. I go downstairs. Kyle's downstairs. He's on his phone. And I go, Kyle, I think I found the root of all my problems. And he looks at me and he says, really? I go, yeah, I don't know how to tell you what I'm about to tell you. But I'm kind of excited about it. Like, true. Like, this is exactly kind of what I'm saying to him. And he's like, what? I go, I realize that I wanted to be aborted when I was a fetus. I really did. And I weirdly feel amazing knowing this now. Like, truly levity, true relief, true, like, oh my gosh, like it was the missing piece. Like we got to the root of the problem. And ever since then, this was about a month ago, I'd say maybe a month and a half ago, I just have felt a lot lighter. Now that doesn't mean I'm not still depressed. This doesn't mean I don't still have panic attacks. And this was also something I was not expecting. It helped me to both empathize with my mother a little bit more. A little bit of context. I've been no contact with her for about a year and a half now, maybe a little bit more, which has actually been very healthy for me to figure out who am I that's not being manipulated by the stories that she's telling me. So there's that. I come to you as a fetus who wanted to be aborted. And I think that's a very interesting narrative that is never shared. Mostly what we hear is about advocating for the unborn voice. And I think what my ketamine experience has allowed me to do is understanding that voice is not just verbal. I do believe there is a spiritual component to voice. I mean, again, when I was a fetus, it wasn't like I had a language from which to say, hello, and knocky knocky, I would like to be aborted, please. And I also felt it in my bones when I was able to make that connection. And again, this is just my lived experience. I am not trying to say this should be your experience. I'm not trying to say that all of us that are chronically ill should have been aborted. None of that. Let's not read into this narrative. I'm still sitting with it. But what I can tell you is my truth with a lowercase t is that I made that connection. I understand that for myself. And I can also objectively tell you that I feel relief now that I know that about myself. And so, what have I done since then? I have spoken to some people about ketamine a little bit more. I have decided that if and when I decide to move forward with doing ketamine again, that I want to do it on a one time a month basis. Something about research that's very important for all of us to know is this. The research points to the efficacy of ketamine being 6 sessions in 4 weeks. That's how you get the most bang for your buck, if you will. But we have to understand that a lot of this research is done on privileged bodies, mostly male, mostly white. Now, I want to be very transparent. I haven't gone and dug into that research to be able to say that definitively about this research pertaining to ketamine. But it is very important that we center our intuition more than we center the research. And that this is by no means me saying that I don't believe in science. It's very much a both and approach. I believe we should take both science and a higher level of understanding, which is an intuitive understanding, and not needing to have a rationale for why you feel a certain way, just advocating for it because that's what you want and you feel comfortable with. So I've been talking to some people. I've decided that if and when I start ketamine again, that I want to go to doing just once a month. Maybe even do twice a month, so a bi-weekly, and then providing myself time in between to really let that ketamine experience settle in the background. So me not necessarily hypervigilantly trying to make sense of it. And I want to share that with you all to let you know that that's an option, right? Like a lot of these doctor's offices will be like, yeah, we do 6 sessions in 4 weeks, right? And that's just, they get used to kind of just saying that. And they forget that there's a lot of other options on the table. And the one, my word for the year, my value for the year, if not longer than this, is autonomy, it's agency. And I very much value that. I want you to feel like you have all as many options on the table for you to choose from, especially in a country such as the United States, and maybe this is similar for other countries that don't let they either take away options such as bodily autonomy, they tie your hands behind your back because of insurance and how expensive medicine is here in this country. So that's what I want to do moving forward with the ketamine. Another thing that came up for me with ketamine that is now actually coming back to me. I might get emotional about this, but that's okay. Like, I mean, that's my emotional self is where my power comes from. I was speaking with Kyle. I finally shared with him about my autoimmune diagnosis. I told him we weren't 100% sure yet what it was. I was sobbing. And I told him that I had also recently come to the realization about being very, very mad that I was not given the option to just die. That we, as at least in this country as a society, and maybe this is in other countries too, I don't want to assume that is the generalized globally, but we in the United States have a very averse relationship to death, and so we don't talk about it. And there's also a morality around living and fighting to live. And I am really fucking pissed that when people were sitting down going, this is the journey that you're looking at. You're looking down the barrel of a transplant, of stent placements, of you name it. Like, we can't actually tell you what the road is because we know nothing about it because we don't give a shit about really women's health that also impacts men. I digress. But I'm really mad that there was not a, okay, here's your options, right? Like, let's take Nutcracker Syndrome, right? This is the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast. I'm really mad that when they sat down and said, okay, here's your options to fix this. You can either do the left renal vein transposition, a left renal vein stent, donate your kidney, or relocate your kidney. I am so mad that they didn't also say, and if you decide that you don't want to do any of this, we can talk about assisted suicide. I'm really grappling with that. Because looking back at the last 3 years, I don't think anybody should have had to have gone through what I have gone through or what you listening to this have gone through. I really don't. My view on assisted suicide is completely different now. I wanted not to say that when I came into it, I was so against it. But that has led me to really dig into learning more about death. I have read a couple books on death. I've looked into different cultural stances on death too. I was reading a book, The Tibetan Book of Death and Living, or I think it's The Tibetan Book of Dying and Living. I forget the exact, so that I could kind of get this Buddhist take on death. I read another book that is called, let me actually Google it really quick. I believe it's called like The Good Death. Let me look. From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death by Mortician Caitlin Dowdy, I think is how you say their name. And they are going through exploring how different cultures manage death and mourning. And that has been really profound for me. And it's really helped me. I had a therapist once tell me that the only real relationship we have is with death. It's the only permanent relationship we have. And so, whatever your relationship is like with death, so if it's averse, it's avoidant, it's anxious, whatever, that avoidance and anxiety comes up in it, presents itself in the rela your romantic relationships, your friendships, your familial relationships, maybe. And I'm still really holding on to that piece for myself. Of what my relationship with death is averse, because I was raised in a culture that not only is averse to death, but I was also raised in a Southern Baptist background, which was, well, you don't need to be scared of dying. You're just going to go to heaven, right? You've accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord in your heart. And I do want to just make it for the record, I do not identify as a Christian anymore. I do not believe that Jesus is the only way, the truth, and the life. I do not believe that. In my bones, I don't believe that. And that is my truth with a lowercase t. Please hear me when I say this. This is not me trying to impose my belief onto you. But in my religious culture, it was a, well, we don't even need to talk about death because we should be joyful about death coming, right? Because then we'll be able to get to heaven. But it was never a, like, nobody's talking about the process of death. Nobody's talking about the pain of death, right? So this is something that I have really been grappling with as well, is this concept of death. I have been allowing, almost kind of against my automatic self, really marinating in my depression. To the point that I very actively let people know when I am feeling suicidal. I very actively say I've let them know how I would do it. And really kind of, I don't know how to say this, but I want to normalize it for you all. I'm really grappling with wanting to stay here. Putting my hand on my chest. Because I think it's really important we talk about this. I think it's really important that we don't just keep suicide and the thought of death, because this is a very scary process. I mean, Kyle thankfully was there through it all, and he's helped normalize. He was like, Simone, you were months away from dying when I had my auto transplant. And I felt that in my bones, but I like couldn't allow myself to like truly accept it because I was in such deep survival mode. And I just want to be vulnerable and share with you all this very real reality. And I'll end with this. After I had my auto transplant, I met a person in the gift shop on day five of inpatient. And I really almost feel as if that person was sent to me as a bit of a messenger, as a bit of an enlightened witness on the other side. Because he comes up, he goes, oh, you must be a transplant patient. I know what that looks like. And I did. I mean, I look like a cancer patient, honestly. We're chatting. He was a double lung transplant. I was telling him about my kidney auto transplant. And right, I said we were about to leave. And he goes, "Oh, by the way, don't underestimate the level of anxiety and depression that come after this." And originally I thought, "Oh, well, I'm not a traditional transplant. I'm not on immunosuppressants," which now I am, LOL. I'm on Plaquenil, which is a immunomodifier, excuse me, but whatever. So, and he wasn't wrong. But at the time I was like, well, I'm not on immunosuppressants and I'm not like a traditional transplant patient, so maybe I won't. And yeah, he's not wrong. It has been a pretty massive clusterfuck mentally for me since the transplant. There have been really good times, but I'm definitely still in the trenches. And I share my relationship with death, my thoughts about not wanting to be here. And I would really appreciate if it, this was not met with, "Oh my gosh, please stay," right? Like, please don't do that. Don't minimize the part of me that just needs to be depressed. Don't minimize the part of me that does think about killing myself from time to time. Because that part has been minimized so much over my life, which is why it's so loud now. So I would rather this be met with, "I can understand how you feel this way. Thank you for sharing your lived experience. It's so beautiful." Because the suicidal part of me, the part of me that does want to kill myself and does contemplate whether I want to stay here, is a very beautiful part of me. And I am creating space for it. And my hope is that by sharing some of my lived experience, that it will encourage you to make space for it as well, to show up compassionately for this part of you, to seek therapy, to discuss this part of you, which I've actually done. I've been deeply like looking into therapists for me to be able to say, "Hey, I want to talk about suicide. I don't want to be scared of it anymore." And not, I truly want to sit here and say, I really don't think I'm going to act upon it. I really don't. I have a lot of really fun things that I have moving forward. But I do think it's very important that I center it for a second instead of just like, "Oh, well, let's not have that thought. Oh, let me push that down. Oh, let me." Because to some extent, how much has been pushing my depressed self and my suicidal self? And this is not the first time I've felt suicidal. I mean, I can go back to middle school and talk about this. I used to pray to God at the altar to take my life. That's how much I wanted to not be here from a young age. But you're kind of taught, "Oh, don't have those thoughts. Oh my gosh, you should stay here." And you're just constantly minimized. And how much am I where I'm at now? How much is my autoimmune condition? Because I was not believed, I was not heard, I was not, people didn't seek to try to understand me. This is obviously a heavy episode, but I do think it's important that we have these conversations in this space. There is one thing I am very confident in. If I would not have gotten my diagnosis of nutcracker, I would not be here today. Either the compression itself would have killed me or I would have killed myself. That amount of pain that we go through, on top of being gaslit, I don't think anybody should have to navigate the world like that. And I also don't think people should be downplayed or minimized by couching that into a morality narrative. of, well, if you do take your life, if you do kill yourself, you're morally inferior. Want to welcome you to, as we conclude this episode, maybe if you feel comfortable putting your hand on your heart, like I often do, just taking a couple seconds to ground ourselves into this moment, honoring what we might be feeling. Maybe even taking a moment to say to these feelings, no matter how uncomfortable this might be, I still love you. And because of that, I sit with you. Maybe taking one last moment to take a deep inhale in and a full slow exhale out as we continue on with our days, maybe sitting with this for a little longer. I encourage you all to reach out for support, whether that's on the Facebook boards, whether that is with a mental health provider, whether that is speaking to your primary health care provider about the thoughts that you're having, whatever that might be. Just know that this podcast is here for you, and I record this episode from a place of love, not just for myself, but a place of love for you who are listening. May you be happy. May you be healthy, and may you be free from suffering.